Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, 2 weeks in a row, you brought the wine. And it's really cold outside, so of course you brought white wine. What are we looking at here? I can already see. It's called Island Tide. It's a 2017 Sauvignon Blanc of New Zealand. And of course you're talking about Serenity.
Because it takes place on an island.
Very much an island.
And it's all about, you know, going out fishing at low tide or high tide or whatever tide that that character likes to go out fishing during.
Matthew McConaughey does talk about tides.
Yeah, so there you go. Island Tide. So a little.
Well, thank you. It tastes pretty good.
Yeah, a little bit of the islands bringing you something warm to Cinema Clash on this very cold evening.
But we'll circle back to Serenity. I want to start this episode with what I believe will be the weekend's biggest film, and it's a kid's film. It's not even anime. It's a live-action kid's film, which usually actually don't make a lot of money, but maybe this one will break the trend. Now, we're talking about The Kid Who Would Be King, a King Arthur movie, because we don't have enough of those. The Kid Who Would Be King, following, what was it, last year's Guy Ritchie's King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which I don't think you saw, but I saw it, actually, in the minority. I really liked it. 2004's King Arthur with Clive Owen and Keira Knightley. Mm-hmm. There was First Knight. Remember Richard Gere hanging out as Lancelot. Excalibur from 81. Sword in the Stone, Disney version. So there's a long lineage of King Arthur. Now we're in present day. We're not back in medieval times or whenever people say a version of the real Arthur actually lived. Alex is, I don't know, he looks about 12 or 13. He's in middle school. And the world is actually quite real. It's not doing too well. People are in a funk. All the newspapers say gloom and war, and there's Brexit, and there's bullies at school, and people don't treat him very well. And one day, when he's running away from bullies, he stumbles across Excalibur, the sword in the stone. And thank goodness, because weird things are starting to happen. Ironclad zombie knights are crawling out of the ground, and they're on fire. There's a witch brewing under the ground. He's got to put a team together, including the bullies, because only they, in true kids' movie fashion, can save the world. Adults just don't understand. The principal doesn't get it. His mom doesn't get it. She thinks Excalibur is a dangerous toy, and before he goes off playing Camelot and Round Table, he needs to finish his homework. I got a kick out of the Kid Who Would Be King. I really liked it, and I really liked, my favorite character was Merlin, played by Angus Emery, and I recognize that last name because he is the son of Celia Emery. Mm-hmm. I think we most recently saw her in Mamma Mia.
There's a lot of lineage in this movie.
I did notice that Alex is played by Louis Ashburn Circus, son of Andy Circus, a director and actor. And Louis Ashburn Circus was the voice of the White Wolf in Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle. Nothing good happens to that guy. So they go on adventures. They have to learn to cooperate, trust each other, work together to save the world. I really liked it because it has a good message. It's not pandering. It's not trying to sell anybody toys. And it says, you know what? If you live by chivalry, if you live by the chivalric code, then you can defeat evil.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. You can't argue with the message that this film's trying to send. I did feel, especially for a PG movie, that it was at least a half hour too long. It was close to 2 hours. And the kids next to me were definitely getting restless. So I think it just depends on your kid. I think the kid who was restless was probably about 8. So I'm not quite sure exactly who that, you know, perfect age range is for this particular movie. But it is very, it's heartfelt. It means well. It's a good adventure kid movie. And many times, and it's got, you liked young Merlin, but it's actually also got Patrick Stewart as old Merlin, who reverses, I think Merlin actually ages backwards. So the younger he looks, apparently the smarter he's become and the wiser. But I do think that this movie gains a little extra gravitas by having Patrick Stewart in there. And so it's, Yeah, and it's just that I like the idea that there's this movie that's kind of tackling the whole bully message in this day and age. So it's almost like if you took the messages of eighth grade and you put it into modern day England with a throwback to the magical, mystical era of Excalibur, then you have this very interesting, timely story.
I actually didn't think Patrick Stewart was necessary. In fact, I think he dragged down the film a little bit. Angus Embree was doing just fine, and he's very funny, and he has these awesome hand movements, which you may bring up later. I don't know. Patrick Stewart just wasn't working for me, and I think it was more of a nudge-nudge, wink-wink that he was in it, because he was in 81's Excalibur, and more of a bit part. There was a sub-theme that kind of did slow the pacing down and kill the momentum, and that's when Alex is searching for his absent father, mm-hmm. who he thinks is somehow connected with all this and left him a kid's book of King Arthur on purpose with an inscription. It clears itself all up, but it really, it goes nowhere, and I believe it was unnecessary. I love the director, Joe Cornish. This is his second feature. His first one was awesome, 2011's Attack the Block, where disparate people who have nothing in common in a low-income London block have to work together to fight off aliens, which is awesome. And actually, I think that was John Boyega's first film.
Oh.
And Joe Cornish went on to write Ant-Man.
Excellent.
And I think his follow-up, Kid Who Would Be King, is serviceable. I think it's really good. Because kid movies can be really bad, especially the live-action ones. And this one just has a wonderful message.
Yeah, and it's sort of a King Arthur meets Harry Potter light is how I view this world that they're in. And so if you took elements of that, I mean, it doesn't rise to the level of a Harry Potter franchise movie. But I do think that to me it felt, especially with the young Merlin and his goofy hand gestures that I am convinced kids all around the country will be doing in the next few months.
I disagree.
In the next few weeks.
It will not catch on.
See. I think it will catch on. I think if you see this movie, you will start trying to do all the little magical spells with your hands. It's goofy. It's very goofy, but it's kind of fun too. But I do think that it felt a bit like this big budget Disney Channel movie to me. Like that's the vibe that I still got from it, that it is this kid adventure and, you know, got this middle schooler who's being bullied. He's got to turn, he knights the bullies so that they can help him in his fight against the evil things. There's a really great CGI sequence where they're learning to fight with swords from some trees that basically come alive and teach them how to fight. So stuff like that you wouldn't be able to get in a standard television movie. And so I think that was that adds a level to making this more of a just big adventure movie. I'm not sure that I didn't love it. I'm not sure that I'll remember it all that much in the mix when you think about all the different King Arthur Excalibur related stories and storylines that we've seen over the years and we'll surely see in the years to come. But in terms of a reimagining and a retelling of a classic story, it certainly is far and away better than like that recent attempt at redoing Robin Hood that came out a month or two ago that was just horrible and that nobody saw. So I do give it props, especially when you think about what our next film is. Then I think The Kid Who Would Be King just rose to the top of the list of really the best movies of the week.
I did not pick up the Disney vibe. This has a healthy dose of realism in it. And Disney does not do realism. They're more kid-friendly. And while this is, yes, it's for kids, it's not for the kindergartners. I didn't take my six-year-old because not only would he have gotten restless, I think it's a little bit out of his reach.
It's a little dark.
But it's not for high schoolers either.
No.
Because the kids here still have a form of innocence and a form of naivete that anyone in the ninth grade on up would just roll their eyes at and scoff at. This is for, this is for third to fifth graders. Like fifth graders, I think, would just knock this out of the park. This is for them. This is for the fifth grade.
That sounds like a good target. I do think, I'm not saying it's like one of your typical Disney Channel shows. I think it's more of that vibe when you have a very special episode compounded into a movie, if you make it into a two-hour special. That's just the vibe that I got from it. Kudos to the filmmakers for just trying to share a really good message. And it's certainly a good time to have that kind of message where it's like the kids are sort of responsible for bringing some hope back into this dreary world that is so divisive. And so I like that. You really can't argue with that. I just felt, again, that it just I thought it was ending, and then it went on for at least another 20 minutes, and I felt that it could have been tighter.
Well, you mentioned our next film, and yes, they are polar opposites. One's good and one's bad. And we already talked about the good film. I love the advertisement for our next film, Serenity. It has an A-list cast, and the advertisement is Academy Award winner, Matthew McConaughey. Academy Award winner, Anne Hathaway. Academy Award nominee, Diane Lane. Academy Award nominee, Jaimin Hunsu. And Jason Clarke.
Oh, poor Jason. And Jason's actually very good in a lot of films.
I love
Zero Dark Thirty. I love Jason Clarke, but man, there's nothing to love about this movie. But the wine's good.
I like this genre of film. It's a psychological thriller. It's a will you or won't you, because our protagonist, Baker Dill, played by McConaughey, has a choice to make. And who's offering the choice? A femme fatale. So there's a noir portion in here. Anne Hathaway, Karen, is Baker's ex-wife. And years later, she shows up at the bar. Does not belong in that bar, by the way. Just look at her. And she says the words every ex-husband wants to hear. You were right, and I was wrong. I want to pay you $10 million cash for you to kill my husband. And most of the rest of the film is, will Baker Dill kill the husband or will he not kill the husband? And is Karen being truthful? Is she on the up and up, or is there subterfuge? And that, if that was the movie, probably would have been quite good.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I'm sort of going along with it for the first 45 minutes, I would say, because the premise itself, it was intriguing. You've got this A-list cast. You think, what could possibly go wrong? But even early on, I picked up on the fact that it seemed that it was almost overacting taking place. And then I thought, okay, maybe they're going for a little campy atmosphere, especially with the Anne Hathaway character. And then that kind of slips away, and you've got these just weird love scenes with Diane Lane that seem to just sort of be out of nowhere and don't really track. And then you've got a whole lot of characters that don't really track. And then that becomes sort of the whole point of this movie, is that nothing's really supposed to track for you. There's a big plot twist that we can't talk about because that would completely ruin the movie for anyone who would still dare to see it. You've got Baker Dill's character. He's the captain of a fishing boat, and he can use the money. And the ex-wife shows up and says, I'll give you $10 million to take my husband out fishing and basically use him as shark bait, and I really don't care to ever see him again. He's an abusive a-hole. And so you empathize with the Baker Dill character to some degree, but then there are moments you're like, well, okay, I don't like any of these people anymore. And when you don't like any of the characters, it's really hard to care about the resolution of the film. And this is just a resolution that does not make much sense to anybody.
You mentioned overacting, and I picked up on it on a very specific character. There's a cartoon villain. Jason Clarke, as Frank, the current husband, is so over the top, and so they deliberately make him the most disgusting human being you've ever seen on film, and it's just overwrought. It didn't need to be. If writer director Stephen Knight was taking this seriously, he would have dialed Frank down a little bit. But I believe there's a reason Frank is the way he is and acts the way he does. And if you go online and read any article that explains the end, because I haven't done that because I think I got it, but I can see myself maybe later on double-checking if I was right, because it's that convoluted. There's a reason Frank is acting like that. You mentioned Diane Lane. What is going on there? A, it could fall into the paradigm of the ending, which might explain it, or B, most of her character was left on the editing room floor.
Maybe.
There's with something her clothes. There's something wrong with that that character. Something doesn't fit.
It doesn't fit. All I can think and hope is that when you think about this cast, I mean, Matthew McConaughey, Anne Hathaway, Jason Clarke, I mean, it's just you, Diane Lane. You're like, okay, what did they see in this script? And so I'm guessing that they took a leap of faith with the script, that they saw something kind of interstellar-ish going on with the script, and they just believed that somehow it would all magically work. And I think they were just led astray because it doesn't. But I have to believe that they thought it would, and that they read something on paper that they really thought would translate, and sadly it just doesn't, and I just wanted my 2 hours back.
I bet as a script, it does read well. Stephen Knight was so brave here. He really did take a chance, and if he had maybe one more draft, he could have figured it out. Stephen Knight is extremely prolific, not as a director. He did direct Locke, which was Tom Hardy in a BMW for 90 minutes. I loved it. I loved everything about it. But he is a prolific writer. He wrote Eastern Promises, Locke, the one we saw last year with Jessica Chastain when she goes west to paint Sitting Bull, Woman Walks Ahead.
Oh, right.
He wrote Allied with Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard. He wrote Burnt with Bradley Cooper.
Okay.
And he doesn't have to work. You know why? He was a creator of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, perhaps the most watched television show in the history of television. He also wrote the series Peaky Blinders and the series Taboo. The man is prolific. And maybe that's why they're like, yeah, Stephen Knight knows what's going on. Let's take a chance.
Yeah, and obviously they took a chance. They took a gamble, and I think in this case it just did not pay off. But we even talked about a little bit coming out of the film, and the more you try to process the ending and figure things out, the ickier it actually all became.
When we're done with this episode, I want to roll a theory by you, and it's disgusting.
This is offline. Great. Looking forward to that one. You have to PM us in order to find out exactly what that theory might be. So, yeah. So, I mean, again, Serenity was just probably a really great idea in the head of the writer-director, and unfortunately, that's the only. It probably should have stayed there.
No, sir, do not go see this film, folks. No. Not even on a dare. Not even know the twist is everybody talking about. It's not worth your time.
No.
It's a waste of money. It's ridiculous. Our next one's a documentary, and this has a very interesting screening pattern. But before we talk about how it's being released, it's called "Who Will Write Our History." Now, Hannah, who's the Hour and who will write our history?
The Hour is the basically the Polish Jews who were forced into the Warsaw Ghetto by the Germans in around 1940. And when the idea behind it is that German propaganda machine was so prevalent back then, and they were so big on documenting and creating their narrative, and justifying what they were doing to these millions of Polish Jews, that it propelled a sort of a clandestine group of journalists and academics and artists to just sort of realize, oh my gosh, we have to figure out some way to write our own history, so that the record shows what we know was really going on here, and that does not get lost by the German propaganda.
The clandestine group you're talking about is Oineg Shabbos. After 450,000 Jews were confined to a couple city blocks in Warsaw, living on top of each other, dying of disease and starvation, which is all dramatically realized by director Roberta Grossman. they decided, yeah, we have to write your firsthand experiences, write what you see in the street, collect ticket stubs, collect anything that shows our life here. And this, they knew it's not going to end well. Mm-hmm. And they buried it before they were all either escaped or were led to the camps.
Yeah, basically they created these time capsules of documentation. And in order to preserve it, they had to bury it and hope that it would be uncovered when the Warsaw Ghetto was fully liberated, when Warsaw was liberated.
Well, Sunday, the 27th of January, is International Holocaust Remembrance Day. And as part of that, this film is a big part of that. Shepherded around, based around UNESCO in Paris, 350 venues in 55 countries are going to screen this film. And you didn't even have to go outside to do it. Facebook Live will screen this film, so you can watch it for free on Facebook Live on Sunday, 27th of January. Or if you're in D.C., you can go to the Holocaust Memorial Museum. If you're in L.A., you can go to the Museum of Tolerance. It's screening in Warsaw. It's screening in Auschwitz. And it's worth it. I think this is a very worthwhile documentary. I had no idea about Oineg Chavez. I knew about the Warsaw Ghetto because there have been plenty of films about it. Just 2 years ago, The Zookeeper's Wife, starring Jessica Chastain, was about it. And Adrian Brody and The Pianist, who won a Best Actor Oscar, mostly took place in the Warsaw Ghetto. And Adrian Brody's back. He is a voice. So is Joan Allen. They're the voices of the two main people we follow to take us through and learn about what was going on in the streets and in the apartment houses.
Yeah, they're reading. The thing is, these two fine actors, I mean, Adrian Brody and Joan Allen, are actually reading the words from the documentation, from the journal entries and the stories that were discovered in the Oneg Shabbat in these time capsules that they found. And so it's the power of the real photos and the real words that make this film really just kind of captivating in its own way. The stuff with the reenactments, that didn't I wasn't loving the dramatizations of scenes. I know that they kind of have to do it in order to move things along and to kind of bring you into the vibe of this era, but it was truly, for me, the actual letters and words and images that really I thought were the most powerful part of this film. And it's amazing when you think of all of the Holocaust-related films and documentaries that we have seen over the years. I'm constantly amazed when a new story is discovered, and Oneg Chavez is definitely a part of the story that I was not familiar with, and it actually had me going and learning more. Like, I immediately went and tried to find out more about some of these the people that created these documents, that hid them, and Yad Vashem on YouTube. There's a really good sort of just a snippet of what this all is that lays it out in about 5 minutes that is just a really good watch. And so if you don't have a chance to see that film, or after you see Who Will Write Our History, I highly recommend going on to YouTube and finding the Yad Vashem video and just learning more, because it really is. It's the sacrifice and the horror of realizing, what these people were going through, and just how much they were willing to risk to just preserve their history and to serve as a warning not to let this ever happen again, and that people should not forget what went on.
It's worth your time this Sunday. It's so easy. You don't even have to go anywhere. Just log on to Facebook, Google Facebook Live, Who Will Write Our History, and it's not even that long. And it's a compelling story that is worth the ride. I hope you really take a chance and do it.
Absolutely.
All right, for our next two, we split. I watched a brand new Netflix documentary, and Hannah took the plunge on a TNT
limited series.
that she'll tell us about. But first, I wanted to start with another documentary. It's called Fire, The Greatest Party That Never Happened. And I first learned about Fire when it, like everyone else, when it exploded the 27th of April, 2017, on Twitter. They're talking about the Fyre Festival, which is supposed to take place in a very posh, elite, private island in the Bahamas. And when a couple hundred very well-to-do millennials showed up for their private villas and exclusive party on the beach with gourmet food with Blink-182 arrived, they found beat-up FEMA tents, cobbled-together cheese sandwiches, no transportation, certainly no villas, rain-soaked mattresses, and just a god-awful, cataclysmic, apocalyptic mess. And it exploded. And it turns out behind the scenes was the entrepreneur slash con artist in charge of it all called Billy McFarland. He's the one who co-founded Fyre, an app where you could book celebrities for particular events. He also founded the credit card for well-to-do millennials called Magnesis. Him and Ja Rule promised supermodels and yachts, but they delivered garbage. And it's really how one man engineered a music festival disaster. And personally, I felt Fyre, the greatest party that never happened, was a little bit rushed. They got some interviews. It felt a little bit cobbled together and haphazard. I'm glad I watched it because I learned more about this. What really is just become a, it's going to become a meme. Well, it already is a meme. I mean, if something's bad, I heard today that someone said the Trump administration is the Fyre Festival of politics. But there's even more going on behind it. This is not the only documentary released this week about the Fyre Festival. This was on Netflix. On Hulu, you can go watch Fyre Fraud. It's also an hour and a half, 2 hour documentary about the Fyre Festival. They released it 4 days before Netflix released theirs, and they got an interview with Billy McFarland. But now they're slinging ethics mud at each other.
Yeah, how ironic is that?
Fyre Fraud paid Billy McFarland for that interview. But on the other hand, Fyre, the greatest party, blah, 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 co-produced the film with some of the vendors and promoters behind the festival. So did they go softer on the criticism there? So they're fighting. They're fighting in the background with these two documentaries released in the same week. I don't know who's trying to scam who here. I haven't seen both of them. Maybe they should be both watched as bookends. Maybe one's combined. Better than the other. I don't know. I only saw the first Netflix one. And it's worth it just to, because you don't feel bad about these kids. They're going purposely on this for a weekend of hedonism, which, you know, I don't feel bad for them. I felt bad for the native Bahamians, the local vendors and day laborers who did not get paid. They did not get, Billy McFarland left the island and said, I'm out of here. And nobody got paid for their work. And people were out thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it just missed the documentary missed the bigger picture. It was a look at millennials and a party gone bad when it should have been about maybe a wider culture.
Absolutely.
Race was in there, materialism, status, all of that should have been, with a little bit more time lapse, should have been dived into instead of competing Netflix and Hulu with each other to race a product to streaming.
Yeah, I think in the era of GoFundMe and Kickstarter and all these things that just kind of grow out of social media and snowball and people just latch onto and believe the first thing that they see and read and the promises that are made, I think it absolutely should serve as a cautionary tale. And that's probably the way it should be framed, because I remember when the news broke about this. And yeah, maybe it needs a little more time to really process how what happened fits into the broader scheme of things in our world today. But yeah, it's hopefully people will watch it to take note of exactly how the wool was pulled over the eyes of so many people, and also just greed, you know, the greed factor for people who just are willing to just roll over so many other people in an attempt to just make a buck and earn. You know, these are people who just live for celebrity and fame and recognition, regardless of how they get it. And that's just a shame. And so, yeah, I'm not sure if I will be able to catch up on that festival, on those documentaries. But definitely, if you heard about that disaster and are interested in learning more, then you have two ways to check it out.
Yeah, well, the audiences are built in. Netflix subscribers, you can watch yours. Hulu subscribers, you can watch yours.
There you go.
If you subscribe to both, let us know which one's better. If you just subscribe to none, well, maybe you can check out the limited series that Hannah's about to talk about.
Yeah, because this one that I saw is going to be on TNT starting on Monday, January 28th. And what's the reason that I decided to go ahead and watch it when I was sent some preview links to all six episodes of this limited series called I Am the Night is that it's from director Patty Jenkins and writer Sam Sheridan, and it stars Chris Pine. And so people will know that Jenkins and Pine worked together on Wonder Woman. And this is quite a, quite a pedigree for this TNT drama. So that's why I was drawn into seeing it. You talk about your noir. This is a television film noir. It takes place, it's a six-episode sort of suspense drama. It takes place in the mid-60s in Los Angeles and Nevada, and it's connected to the infamous Los Angeles murder, the notorious Black Dahlia case that remains technically unsolved, but makes a case, this drama certainly makes the case that that this Dr. Hodel is responsible. And so the six-part series is inspired by these true events. It tells the story of this girl, Fauna Hodel, played by India Isley, and she finds out she was given away at birth. She's lived more or less comfortably with who she is and didn't really think much about the mysteries of her past, but then she stumbles across some information and decides that she really wants to go in search of really where she came from and who her birth mother, birth parents are. And it's this very slow unfolding, dark, sometimes quite violent noir that, psychological drama, everything kind of gradually reveals the secrets of her past. And Chris Pine plays this ruined reporter who had tracked the case of the Black Dahlia case and the trial of this Dr. George Hodel. And it basically ruined his career. And so here it is years later, and he connects with Fauna Hodel. And together they kind of work to sort of solve the mystery of her past and try and connect George Hodel to the very shocking Black Dahlia case. And so it's got a lot of atmosphere. It's a period drama. It's very melodramatic music that plays quite heavy. You talk about a risk. We talked about a risk with Serenity and with that director. I think there's some risk to putting this on commercial television. I'm not sure how it will translate. We'll have to wait and see. It feels to me like something that would need to be binge-watched. And so if it's playing out over the course of like 6 weeks on TNT, then I think that's going to be really difficult for people to stick with it. Because after about two episodes, I was kind of ready to give it up. But Chris Pine is still a very endearing kind of character. I mean, in this movie, in this TV movie, he is very damaged goods. He's snorting cocaine and he drinks a lot. He's got PTSD. He was in the Korean War. So he's got a lot of his own baggage. And he sort of shifts from being this somewhat likable guy to being, this poor schmo who's just getting beaten up all the time by the cops. It's, again, if you like a slow burn mystery psychological drama, you might actually get something out of this. If you have any backstory, background on the Black Dahlia murder cases, if that's something that's sort of always intrigued you, then this limited series definitely takes a stab at creating the narrative of what likely happened with Black Dahlia.
Well, film noir is really, if not one of my favorite genres, so it does sound very appealing. And I remember that when the Black Dahlia movie came out. I think it was in the early 2000s. I really liked that film. So yeah, this TV show, while I would never have time for it since we are still in peak TV, it sounds right up my alley. It sounds amazing.
Well, and that's going to be the challenge, is can it find an audience? There's also a companion podcast documentary series that is going to premiere in mid-February that's called Root of Evil, The True Story of the Hodel Family and the Black Dahlia. And that's actually hosted by Fauna Hodel's daughters and features, in their own words, sort of this behind-the-scenes account of what it was like, this multi-generational curse, you know, having that Hodel name and having the cloud over the family of the potential connection to Black Dahlia. So I think, you know, anyone who kind of also likes to expand, you know, you watch the series and then you watch the you listen to the companion podcast. It's an intriguing concept. It's a lot of time to invest and again, probably a bit of a gamble for TNT, but we'll see if it works. Without Patty Jenkins and Chris Pine, I doubt it would, but you've got those two going to bat for it, so we'll see.
I hope it does work. It's an interesting follow-up choice for Patty Jenkins after scoring an amazing success with a DC comic book film to run back to a TV show. So the script must be quite compelling for to make her do that.
And I think Chris Pine enjoyed the challenge of going into the mind of this very damaged reporter guy, and he's certainly no Chris Trevor or no Steve Trevor in this particular film, but definitely an interesting thing. And the whole idea is that some stories will eat you alive, and the idea is that this particular story is eating at him.
Outstanding. All right, well, now's that time in the show where this is the third time we're going to do this. Agree or disagree? Throughout the week, our faithful podcast listeners pitch us their ideas for us to throw at one another about and agree with this statement or disagree with this statement, and just immediate gut reaction. And I have a couple doozies for Hannah this week. I guarantee you things she's never thought about before. But I know
probably for good reason too.
We'll see. Hers are, I think, more based around the Oscar nominations, mm-hmm. which debuted Tuesday morning. I swore on last week's agree or disagree, I swore I would not watch it live. I lied. I did. I even took notes.
I know. You started tweeting out, and I'm like, he's watching this live. There's no way he is not watching it. So
I did. I didn't think I was, but I was sitting at my desk. I was at a down moment, and I was like, you know what? I think the Oscars about to thin. All right, turn it on.
Yep. And here, I thought for sure we'd go with an Oscar-themed agree or disagree, but mine will be within that theme. But you can go ahead and...
No, I only have two. Do you have more than two?
I got a few that are all Oscar-related.
Baddest leadoff.
And I do think that it's worth just a quick recap of those nominations in terms of the...
Real quick.
The biggest surprises. So, biggest snub ever, Won't You Be My Neighbor, should have been in that Best Documentary category. Mm. And then that will lead me into the agree or disagree that came from our devoted listener, Brett Sonnenschein out in New York, who said, agree or disagree, RBG for Best Documentary Feature is the surest pick in this year's Oscar pool.
I disagree. Not by a long shot. In fact, I don't think it will win Best Documentary. But to answer your question directly, the surest winner of any Oscar is the song Shallow by Lady Gaga. I guarantee you 101% Lady Gaga will win an Oscar for best song.
Yeah, there's no question about that one. But RBG, I thought, was, given the fact that Won't You Be My Neighbor, the Mr. Rogers documentary, is missing from that list, I actually do think that maybe RBG is not such a sure bet.
No, RBG is, I don't even think, is the favorite to win that category. I think it's actually Minding the Gap,
which I still need to see.
And even then, that's a toss-up category.
It is.
It could go in any direction. If there was a, all right, of course, everyone knows that Shallow's going to win an Oscar. Well, what's the second most lock of a category? Easy. Best makeup. Going to Vice.
Right. But I was just so disappointed by Won't You Be My Neighbor not being in that category, because I think that was the best movie with the message that we most need to be embracing right now. And so that was a bummer. And but you talked about the best song automatically being a sure bet for Shallow mm-hmm. from A Star Is Born, which I completely agree. But the Academy's decision, or I don't know if they were floating that out there as a trial balloon, because I think they're going to get so busted.
The producer's
that they're
decision.
Going to have to change it, that they were only going to have two performances from that category performed at the Oscars, and that is a travesty. One, you're basically saying, we nominated five songs for this category, but we only think two are even viable candidates, and one is the sure winner, Shallow, so we want that one performed on the show because that'll draw a lot of eyeballs. Well, I think that that's just a total miscarriage of justice, and it's one of my favorite parts of the telecast is I want to see and here, it's only five songs. For heaven's sakes, you can carve out the time for those five songs and just skip some of the really stupid feature, like little mini interstitials and the gags with the audience and all of that stuff. And there is a way in a 3+ hour telecast to put five song performances in there.
Well, in past years, they have done all five songs, all sung live in their entirety. And that's, you know, those are years when the Oscars get slaughtered for taking too much time. There have been years where they just do a medley, put all five songs together, and they each get 30 seconds. Last year, they gave 3 to 4 full minutes to This Is Me from The Greatest Showman, but Sufjan Stevens for Call Me By Your Name only got 90 seconds. I agree. If they cut out garbage like unsuspecting tourists showing up to a right. Wrinkle in Time screening or whatever,
handing out Girl Scout cookies or pizza,
they would have easy enough time for five. If they're going to have any songs performed live, it has to be all five. In fact, like The Shallow is not even like I know it's going to win. It's not even my favorite song. I'd rather see All the Stars from Black Panther perform. That's my favorite song. I also want to see the Buster Scruggs song perform.
And I think people want to see Emily Blunt perform the song from Mary Poppins, and Lin-Manuel Miranda tweeted,
I don't know if they'll get Emily Blunt. If you don't nominate her for for the two films she was in, why would she show up to sing for you?
Well, because I think Lin-Manuel Miranda is actually going to plug that.
But he can't sing it. It's not his song.
No. But I think he carries a lot of weight, and I think his distress over...
They're going to change it.
They will change it.
The producer right now is taking an ungodly amount of heat.
And deservedly so.
They're going to change it.
So those are my sort of Oscar themed agree or disagree. There are a few other disappointments or snubs, I guess you could say. But for the most part, you know, nothing out of the ordinary from year to year.
Oh, I have my heartburn, but I don't need to get into that. If Beale Street could talk.
All right.
My first one, the Screen Actors Guild Awards mm-hmm. are this Sunday night. In its 25-year history, 17 films have earned 4 SAG nominations, with 6 of them winning all of them. 4 of them have lost all 4. Brokeback Mountain, English Patient, Into the Wild, and Manchester by the Sea didn't win a single.
Hold on, I lost. Wait, what?
So
go back a minute.
Let's talk. All right, we're talking about the Screen Actors Guild Awards. That means cast in a major motion film.
Right.
Best actor.
The actor.
Best actress.
Sure.
And a supporting one.
Mm-hmm.
So only 17 films have been nominated for all 4 big ones.
Okay.
All 4 big ones.
Gotcha.
Out of all those, 6 of them have won them all. Won them all. I think Silence of the Lambs is one of them. 4 of them have not won any. Brokeback Mountain, English Patient, Into the Wild, and Manchester by the Sea. A Star Is Born is the only film this year with 4 nominations.
Mm-hmm.
Agree or disagree? It won't win any.
You know, that's a tough one. I think I agree because I think you pointed out earlier that the nominations, which I think people sometimes forget about for the Oscars, that the nominations themselves are coming from within the industry, that particular group. So you have editors voting on best editing. You have actors voting on the best actors. Directors voting on the best directors. And then the whole Academy then gets to cast a vote based on those nominations. So if you take the – if you figure that the SAG Awards are doing that same thing and these are the actors voting on the actors, then I do think that Glenn Close still will have a lock on Best Actress. I didn't think – Lady Gaga, I love her singing. I loved A Star Is Born, but I'm not so sure. To me, she was not the best actress out of all of these films. And so I can totally understand if the other actors would feel that it was a bit of a there would be a bit of a stunt vote to give Lady Gaga best actor. Bradley Cooper, I think actually if I had to choose, he to me was the strongest. For him to have been singing and acting and directing so well in this film, I think he deserves some kudos, but I think he'd have a hard time breaking through in that Best Actor category. I love Sam Elliott for supporting. He's just a really just instrumental character, but sort of more interjected more briefly than some of the others. And so who would the fourth be?
That's Sam Elliott.
So Sam Elliott.
So cast as a whole,
Cooper, whole
Gaga, and Sam Elliott. I don't think any of them are going to win. I think if one could win, it would be Lady Gaga. She's really got the only chance.
Christian
Bale is going to win.
Christian Bale will win.
Rami Malek on the outside, and Mahershala Ali has the inside track for supporting.
Probably.
It will not be Sam Elliott. And
yeah,
it could be cast as for a whole film, but. There's just too many.
It's tough.
Green Book and The Favorite are still in there. And yeah, Lady Gaga's got the only chance. And she's not going to win. It will be Glenn Close.
No, I agree.
So it's going to go on that list. It's nominated for four, will not win one.
Although it will definitely give us a hint this weekend as to what the, as to who has the true edge for the Academy Awards for the acting category.
SAG Awards are usually a strong predictor of who will win the Oscar. However, Adrian Brody didn't win, and neither did Casey Affleck. So there are rooms for surprises.
Okay. So that was pretty much mine. We're all Academy
okay,
related.
Okay, I got all right. So here's one that you've never thought about, ever. All right, you ready for this?
Yes.
Ideas to get more people to go to the movies. A movie ticket for a film that costs $10 million to make. And a movie ticket for a film that costs $200 million to make should not be the same price.
Is that just flatly agree or
disagree? That's my first one. Agree or disagree? They should not be the same price. No way.
I kind of agree because everything else is parsed out differently. You know, your toll lanes. It's like if you're driving through a toll lane at rush hour versus driving through a toll lane off peak. Or taking the metro. I mean, that's just kind of how the world
is. Well, it's a boon for
monetized
indie films. It means more. It would be cheaper to go see Who Will Write Our History than to go see Aquaman. But right now, it's the same price to go see Aquaman as it is to see Who Will Write Our History.
The only difference is that something like Aquaman or the films that are in 3D and IMAX, where there is a surcharge.
Yeah, keep that the price it is. But there should be less money. I should have to spend less money to go see The Favorite than to see Aquaman.
I think I would agree with that. I think there's nothing wrong with trying to give some added incentive for seeing some of these smaller films. And really, they're not getting the marketing. They're not, you know, why not? If they're not, if they don't have all the franchise money behind it and the merchandising, why not let people see it cheaper? It's kind of what...
You probably, and more people go, so yeah. Maybe would you make more money in the long run?
Absolutely. I think you probably could. And I do think that a lot of people don't go see these smaller movies because they just automatically say, well, I'll just wait and see that on Hulu or Netflix or on the airplane. And I do think that's a shame because some of these smaller films would benefit from the bigger screen.
Furthermore, a ticket for a seat in the middle row, middle seat, should not be the same price as one in the front row on the end.
See, that's where it gets... I kind of disagree.
Think about the plane.
I'm thinking about
plane seats all cost different.
I'm thinking about the early days of Southwest and how I like the democracy of that all and how that's gone away now that, you know, you're expected to pay for early access.
I just wanted to see Felicity Jones and On the Basis of Sex play RBG. And I don't have any money, but I'm already going to get a cheaper ticket because it's not Aquaman. And I promise I won't sit in the good seat. I'll sit way down at the front of the end, so I'll get a discount there too, but I really want to see it.
Well, but so many theaters now allow you that option. So you look at what we have with like the iPic theaters and the Arclight.
So the iPic's the one where you pay for separate. Arclight.
There are a lot of theaters now where you are able to choose your seat when you order your tickets online.
But they're all, other than the iPic, they're all the same price.
No, absolutely. But you have some control over, like anything else, if you buy your ticket far enough, you know, if you are willing to be by your computer as soon as they go on sale, it's kind of the same theory with concerts, with big concerts.
Seats are charged differently.
They are, but...
But not in movie theaters.
But you can still be paying... You're paying the same to be on the outer edge of some section sometimes. As the guy or gal who's in the center... You know, center orchestra, and you're at the very end, and your view is not as good, but you've paid the same price.
Movies look different depending on where you sit. They even sound different.
But how in the world do you even begin to figure out how to break that down?
I guarantee you there's an algorithm for that.
There is, but then there are times where I go into a theater and I'm just shocked that, you know, you can move around because there's absolutely...
it's because tickets are too expensive.
Tickets are too expensive, but I do like your idea. I do think that if you change the algorithm for the price based on how much the movie was cost to make, that's actually a pretty fascinating theory.
Avatar would be the most expensive movie ticket ever.
And you still have to have your limits because I do hate that for so many concerts and things now – And even sporting events, that the ticket charges are just out of reach for so many people. And so I think movies were always designed to be something that was supposed to be economically accessible to the masses, even in the worst of economic times.
The economic masses are priced out of movie theaters now.
And that's a shame because I do think that that's not how movies came about and what it was supposed to be. It was supposed to be a way for people to communally watch stuff. And I just think it's sad that we've lost so much of that people are watching on their own big screen TVs or on their own iPads or computers and not watching movies as much together. They're just not as big of a communal experience as they used to be. Oh. And I think you lose something.
Trust me, after my screening of The Kid Who Would Be King, I understand why you want to stay home.
Well, no, I mean, that's a kid's movie you're going to get.
Oh, it wasn't the kids, let me tell you.
Okay, but, and that's another issue entirely is just the issue, too, with people talking during films and being... and having their cell phones and thinking that they can text without anyone noticing. Like if they just suddenly have like put their coat on top of their computer, on top of their phone, like somehow that light is not going to shine through. And that to me is one of the worst things that ever could have happened to film going. It's just that people are way too easily distracted while watching movies today. And I think that takes a toll.
All right. Well, a quick wrap up. Of the very different pieces of media we've talked about on this episode. We started way back there with The Kid Who Would Be King. I think that's a wonderful kids film, a live-action kids film. Rare nowadays to really get one of those. I think it's got a great message. It's the best film of the week.
Yeah, solid family drama, and we'll see if people catch on with the hand gestures.
No, they won't. Serenity is... he swung the bat... And he whiffed so hard, he caused a hurricane on the other side.
Yeah, I always feel bad when I just see this barrage of terrible reviews. And they have been pretty universally bad for this film. And I try to look for the silver lining with some of these movies. With this one, there just isn't. You can't recommend it.
Who Will Write Our History is being released for International Holocaust Remembrance Day. Remember, you can stay at home and watch it on Facebook Live and learn a facet of World War II that you don't know.
Yeah, it had its world premiere at the San Francisco Jewish Film Festival, and I think this will be a darling on the Jewish Film Festival circuit for sure, but it does deserve to be seen by a lot more people.
Netflix's Fire, The Greatest Party That Never Happened. Yeah, too rushed. It's there if you're a Netflix subscriber. There's another one if you're a Hulu subscriber. Let us know which one's better. I don't know.
I'm going to wait 5 to 10 years for the composite version to come out.
Fair enough.
And then I Am the Night on TNT. Let us know. I'll be really curious to see who feels that that first episode draws them in enough to allow them to commit to a 6-episode limited series. But, you know, when you've got the megastar power wattage of Chris Pine and Patty Jenkins behind it, and just an interesting approach, an interesting story, it's not often that you will get a television film noir, and that's what this is.
As always, please continue to shoot us your ideas for Agree or Disagree, and let us know what you think about the Screen Actors Guild Awards. This Sunday, watch for A Star Is Born to not win anything.
That's right, and we'll have our little debrief on that next week.
All right, well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend at RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.